Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Commentary Track. Delighted to see you again, metaphorically speaking. I'm your affable host, Frank Thompson, winner of 11 Diction Awards. And tonight is a very special episode. And once again, I say tonight, someone please stop me. It's night when I record it. I just can't help when you're listening to it. Tonight is a very special episode. I'm talking with Kevin Brownlow. Now, if you have any interest in film at all, in film history, then I don't have to tell you who Kevin Brownlow is. He is the leading film historian of our time. He is the top of the top. He's the film historian that all of the rest of us aspire to be and will never be. He is not only a terrific writer, but a great filmmaker, a great documentarian. He has done more to celebrate the silent film and educate the world to the true glories of the silent cinema than any single person from the sound era, I guess. He is just the greatest. I first read The Parade's Gone By in the early 70s or mid-70s. A couple of years, I think it was published in 68, so I only came to it 4 or 5 years after it was published, I guess. And it was an eye-opener. It really, I had never found anything of particular depth written about American silent cinema, and this was the greatest book I'd ever seen on that subject. A couple of years later, along comes The War of the West in the Wilderness, and then after that, Behind the Mask of Innocence. And that's only some of the books that Kevin has written. And then there's his work as a documentarian, the 13-part series Hollywood on the silent film, The Unknown Chaplain, which I contend to be one of the greatest film-related documentaries anybody ever made. But he also made documentaries on Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Garbo, Marion C. Cooper, Cecil B. DeMille, on and on and on. Each one terrific, each one thoughtful and filled with new research and engagingly presented. He's really something special. And it tickles me that I have known him for a long time, that we are friends, that we've had some adventures together. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those in this conversation. I want to give you a little heads up. This conversation comes with some bonus footage, kind of like a DVD Easter egg, except you don't have to hunt for it. It's just keep listening and it'll show up. What happened was when we were in Oakland to see Napoleon, which Kevin has restored to its current full length of about 5.5 hours, and it was playing at the Paramount Theater in Oakland with a full orchestra conducted by Carl Davis, who also composed the score and who, parenthetically, will be my guest next week. I went over to interview him at this bed and breakfast in San Francisco on Haight Street, and John Bengtson came with me. If you heard my interview with him a couple of weeks ago, John is also a formidable film historian and just came over to hang out with Kevin a little bit. Then after the interview was over with, John was taking some pictures of us with my camera and couldn't get the flash to work for the longest time. So what you'll hear after the interview seems to be over is us fumfering around and complaining about why the flash isn't going off. All that gradually leads into a little bonus conversation when Kevin starts talking about when he received his honorary Academy Award year before last at the Governor's Awards. And I was lucky enough to be among his guests that night. And it was a great, great, great evening. And the very next day, Kevin and I set out toward Yuma, Arizona, where I showed him the sand dunes where Beaugest's Fort Zinderhoof once stood. And my friend Craig Kovner and I also took Kevin to Hakumba, California, a tiny little town along the way to Yuma from San Diego, which is where William Wellman made Beggars of Life with Richard Arlen, Louise Brooks, and Wallace Beery. If you know Kevin or have seen him being interviewed, you'll know he's the epitome of the English gentleman. And even in the desert, he was wearing his tie and sports jacket. And if you have never seen Kevin in a dune buggy, you ain't lived, let me tell you that. So there's this little extra conversation. So when you think the interview's over, it's not over. Wait till the theme music has ended, and then you'll know the podcast has really ended. So it is with great pleasure I introduce this conversation with my friend, but more important, one of my heroes, Kevin Brownlow. Now, I'm always interested because while none of us is in the first blush of youth, although I like to think that I am, we were also none of us alive during the era of the silent film. And so all of us, all of the silent film historians that I know came after the fact. It's not nostalgia. It's not yearning for our childhoods. It's all something else. And so I'm curious about what brought us to this. And while you and I have talked a little bit about it in the past, we've never talked about it on microphone. So, I mean, surely you were a child like any other child in England and went to the movies and saw what was out. But what happened to get this into your heart the way it did?
I was born 1938, so I grew up imagining that the war had continued throughout. This is normal life, being bombed every night. And finally, my mother sent me away to boarding school at the age of three because she thought the Blitz was going on indefinitely. And the irony was that I was sent to a village in which my grandparents lived, which was right on the invasion route. Had they come, this is where they would have blasted their way through. It also had the largest military camp in England. At this boarding school, we never saw film until Dr. Bernardo's came to pick up the cash from the little houses they used as collection boxes, and as a reward we were shown footage of the orphanage. And I knew nothing about film. I'd never seen a proper film. I'd never seen moving pictures at all, but I knew instinctively that this was very badly shot, and it offended me deeply. I couldn't stand these Dr. Bernardo's films. And when I was finally taken to the first professional film, Snow White, on reissue, the newsreel on with it was so sharp and so beautiful and so static. It wasn't waving around like Dr. Bernardo's, that I fell in love with the whole idea of film at that moment, except to show you how extraordinarily brilliant I was technically. When I saw the four naval officers walking towards the camera, I knew they'd fall out of the screen into the cinema, and I was holding on to the arms waiting for that moment. Then I went to another boarding school in 1946, and it was real, like Colditz. In fact, boys used to escape from it, and they'd send the tradesmen's vans hunting around the countryside to pick them up. But this headmaster, the one decent thing he did was to show us films every third Sunday in the winter. And although he showed us one sound film per term, he couldn't afford a sound projector. So he ran us the films of our parents' generation. We saw Harold Lloyd, Snub Pollard, Chaplin, of course. And it wasn't the films that got me straight away. It was the idea that you could convert a room into a cinema. I thought you had to build an enormous concrete cinema in the high street. So I went on and on at my parents for a projector, but I forgot to say what sort. So when I was 10, I was given a projector. Slide projector. Black Beauty, I'll never forget, this damn horse just standing there, and then endless text on the title frame. So the following Christmas, they got the message, and I got a Pathoscope Ace 9.5mm projector with two very small films, the Naval Review at Spithead, because they knew I was mad about the Navy, and a Mickey Mouse. So I just went out into London, the sort of thing you could do in those days, went out into the streets of London looking for somewhere that sold films. And I immediately found one in Baker Street, and they were 1/6 a reel, which is 15 cents, I suppose. And there were three of them, and I didn't know what the three were, but they looked enticing. And I showed them to my parents, and they were very keen silent film fans from their youth. And the first one was missing its opening. And my mother said, "That's Douglas Fairbanks." And even I'd heard of Douglas Fairbanks, so I was tremendously excited. In fact, I remember... You have to remember my age. I rushed into the chemist, and there was an awfully nice woman there, and I said, "I found a Douglas Fairbanks film." And she responded as though she understood completely, which is just the right thing to do. Anyway, I was on my way to the library because I knew that was where I would find more information. I would find a book. It would fall open at a photograph from it. Tell me the title, the date, and description. And that's exactly what happened. There was one book. There were no media studies, thank God, those days. The History of Film by Bardèche and Brassier. Little did I know they were both fascists, and one of them was shot by the resistance in 1945. And there was a photograph of Doug in a motorboat, and it said American Aristocracy, 1916. And Iris Barry had written how this was his first big success. I loved the film. It looked superb. Beautifully made, beautifully shot. Doug was so charming and so athletic, and it was so funny, written by Anita Loose, and it was about the American aristocracy with the brewers and manufacturers, and a woman comes onto the balcony of this hotel, which turns out to be in Newport, where Douglas Fairbanks Sr.'s wife came from. And she's introduced to a woman, we are Budhauser, you know, the brewers. And this woman says, "Please, we're distillers." And there was also a William S. Hart, the gunfighter, it turned out to be, but they called it The Outlaw, 1916, which I'm actually trying to restore at this very moment in England. And the other one was a Bessie Love film called, the original title was Sister of Six, directed by Sidney and Chester Franklin for Griffith at Fine Arts. Now, my life is noted for its coincidences. We had a theatre near us in Swiss Cottage called the Embassy Theatre, and they just changed the production. New posters had gone up, and I was idly looking at them. I had no interest in the theatre at all. And there I saw Bessie Love in the also-rans, you know, the small part players. And I thought, what a coincidence, you know, it couldn't possibly be the one that is in Hollywood films, but how interesting. On the other hand, I think I'll write her and see if it is the one from Hollywood. And it was. And she wrote, said, "I'd love to see my film. Can I bring my daughter?" So with great suspense and anticipation, we invited her to tea, and it was bitter winter. And my mother had fixed a pelmet above the door with a heavy curtain to keep the draft out, because the whole flat had been shaken up by the Blitz, and bits kept falling off the ceiling even then. And Bessie Love and her daughter arrived. My father opened the front door, escorted them up to our flat. I opened the main door, and the pelmet fell on top of her. Completely buried her. And I just remember the giggle that was coming from inside.
It was a perfect Bessie Love entrance.
Perfect Bessie Love entrance. She was enchanting. And that was 1954. It must have been 53, 54. The year that I bought a very bad French silent film called The Lion of the Moguls with Ivan Mosjoukin, directed by Jean Epstein. And it was reduced from 7 or 8 reels to 1, and it was a bad print, and I thought it was hopeless. So I rang up the library that I bought it from and said, have you got anything that I could exchange it for? And he said, we've only got one title left. It's called Napoleon Bonaparte and the French Revolution. And I said, well, I don't want that because it'll be a classroom film. I'd already got the sense that there are an awful lot of these around. They were constantly trying to educate you. And they would be just like my Black Beauty slide thing. So they said, well, it's all we've got. So I said, okay, I can't stand having this around. It's so awful. So I'll post this back and you send this one in. And a couple of days later, I was at home from school with flu and this parcel arrived and I made a miraculous recovery, got my parents in the front room, closed the curtains and began showing Napoleon Bonaparte and the French Revolution. Was a miraculous piece of work. I had never seen the cinema like this. It was so innovative and so dynamic. It was the cinema as I thought it ought to be, but had never seen example of. So I got extremely excited and tried to find out something about this film, and nobody knew anything about it at all. Well, I had found the British Film Institute, had met the deputy curator, who was an Irishman called Liam O'Leary, who was very keen on silent films and who'd started the same way as I did with a hand-cranked projector. And he told me quite a bit, and I met a journalist who actually had a photograph of the man who made it, which he lent me. And I showed it to Liam, and a few days later, one of these coincidences I can't account for, he looked through his office door, and there was the man from the photograph. What had happened was that Abel Gance had come from Paris to see Cinerama, and he wanted to see how close it was to what he'd invented, as he called Polyvision. And after the show, he came out of the theatre down Shaftesbury Avenue, and although he couldn't speak English very well, he could read British Film Institute, and he just walked in. At which point Liam spotted him, went outside and said in Irish accented French, "Et vous, Monsieur Gonks?" And he was amazed to be recognised because he hadn't made a film for 12 years. And immediately Liam managed to get the director of the BFI to set up a reception at the National Film Theatre, and he rang my mother. And my mother, being my mother, thank God, I was doing a mock school certificate exam at school, and nothing would get me out of that. But if a parent rang the school, it usually meant a death in the family. And so they let me go without question. And I rushed home, picked up the scenario, which was on sale from 1927, and I bought it over the counter at a French shop in Regent Street, and stills that I had, and went off to the NFT, just in time to see the taxi arrive. And I had written a fan letter to Gans, and I had had an answer, so I had some idea that he was still alive. He looked quite youthful. He was in his, I suppose he was in his 60s, early 60s. And he really looked just as one wanted him to look, like a medieval saint, a wonderful, handsome face, aquiline nose, his hair swept back, and a sort of great charisma about him. And I don't know how we talked to each other. We must have had an interpreter. And I remember at the end, he said, and I understood his French as he left, he said, the first thing he did was he refused a drink. And now he went round emptying everybody's. And somebody said, I thought you didn't drink. He said, only at times like this. And then he said as he left, you know, as far as work in the industry is concerned, keep your eyes straight ahead. Then he said, non, les yeux pour la vision.
Uh, To backtrack just a bit, when Bessie Love came to your house and you showed her the film, did you actually interview her, or did you just make the contact?
Because
you did keep in contact with her for the rest of her life.
I didn't understand the business of interviewing,
sure.
The importance of interviewing. Of course, I asked questions and promptly forgot them. I don't know what she said in answer to my questions at that stage. And then I must have got the idea that meeting the pioneers, I ought to do a proper interview, because I began writing them for a magazine, amateur cine magazine. And the first one was connected to the pioneer called R.W. Paul. And he was in Cricklewood, I remember. And I didn't know what to ask him. I knew nothing about this R.W. Paul. And he didn't want to talk to me. He was embarrassed. And I found out why. Because he turned out he was the boy holding the horse when R.W. Paul went into his laboratory and discovered that limelight could be used for projection. And it was his eureka moment. And the horse did it. And that was it. Poor bloke was just an old horseman, you know, that had done nothing all his life. And anyway, that really nearly put me off. But luckily, the appearance of Bessie Love and a few others, I went to see Percy Marmont. And the Douglas Fairbanks film has a story attached to it. Do you want the story attached to it?
Sure.
Which is quite important in my career. I was always keen to find out more about the film I'd just bought. And I had joined the British Film Institute at the age of 13, I think I was. And they had the index to the work of D.W. Griffith. And Seymour Stern had produced this, presumably through the Museum of Modern Art. And he seemed to think that films like American Aristocracy were supervised by Griffith. And how could they have been? That picture was made in the East, and Griffith's hard at work on Intolerance in the West. But it was just as well he had this misconception, because he provided the cast list. And I remembered it. I remember everybody in that cast. And when I joined the film industry at the age of 17, I kept hearing people talk about an actor's agency called the Al Parker Agency. It had discovered James Mason, Richard Attenborough, and there's somebody else very famous. Oh, Trevor Howard. Of course, having a one-track mind, I knew that this was the villain in American Aristocracy, Albert S. Parker. So I found out his phone number, rang him up, and sure enough, he had an American accent. Great. I said, does the name Douglas Fairbanks mean anything to you? He said, Doug, Jesus Christ, I directed him. I said, oh, did you, what did you direct? The Black Pirate. Oh! Anyway, I think I've got an early film of you. Bring it over. So I bought my projector and I bought the film, and I met this expansive, funny, dynamic character called Al Parker. He was married to Margaret Johnston. And we ran it on all the way around his office wall were pictures from the Black Pirate. And in black and white, oddly enough. Anyway, I ran it on. And he was entranced. We had to do it all over again for Margaret Johnston. And then he organized a dinner for all his actors. So I got to meet Clive Brook, James Mason, Trevor Howard, Hardy Krueger. And we had these regularly silent film evenings. And of course I got to know James Mason, who became the narrator of the Hollywood series. And then, because Parker was an actor's agent, he would get celebrity bulletin, And if he saw somebody coming to town, he'd get in touch and say, King Vidor, Hyde Park Hotel, tell him I sent you. So that one film served me extremely well. When I eventually got to America the first time in 64, I went to see Don Malkane's, and he had a setup, a projection setup with 35 and 28 millimeter projectors. I'm sure it was an arc projector because it gave the most wonderful picture. He had the whole film. Mine was a cut down version on 9.5 in 3 60-foot reels. Mm-hmm. And this was all five reels tinted and toned and everything, and gorgeous. And it was photographed by Victor Fleming. So it was very useful buying that film at 1 and 6 a reel.
Now, your book, The Parade's Gone By, was one of those turning point books in my life, as I'm sure it was in many people's lives. And I will admit to you freely and frankly that the only reason I bought it was there was a chapter on William Wellman in it. And I saw this and I thought, oh, I got to buy this book. And I was already interested in silent film, but having grown up in South Carolina, had virtually no access except through Black Hawk.
Did I tell you that the girl I was actually chasing to come over here was from North Carolina?
From Asheville.
Asheville. I just spoke to her this morning.
Ah. Yes, you and my wife and I are considering moving to Asheville, and you said that. So who knows? We may be friends soon. but
the book. Yes, I'll tell you.
The parade's gone by. When did you start? In the early 60s, mid-60s?
No, I had absolutely no intention of writing that book at all. It was a method to get to see, to meet the people. I just wanted to meet the people, get the information. I didn't want to write a book. I had no idea how to do it. I had an inspiration one afternoon, I remember, and I sat down and typed the first page, and that's all I did. I put it away and forgot about it. And then when I got to New York and started, the Sloan, my girlfriend, was an actress and she was rehearsing. And so I had an awful lot of spare time. And that was when I began looking up the telephone book to see if I could find some interesting names. James Morrison, he was at Vitagraph. Let's go see him. And he lives in Greenwich Village around the corner. But still, I used the book to get to meet them. Again, made no attempt. Luckily, I was recording the interviews, which is why what he said was so horrible about the 2-inch tape.
Yes, we were talking with somebody earlier who was talking about how 2-inch tape or the magnetic tape will flake. And you have to bake it to get one last. That's the reference that we're making here to a previous conversation. Yes.
But when I got to Hollywood, I had been stood up by the Duncan sisters, one of the Duncan sisters.
I hate when that happens.
And I was sitting in the foyer, and there was an old lady sitting on the sofa nearby. I was gazing at the photographs of past presidents, and so was she. And she said, "Who's that?" And we were both looking at this. I said, "Well, that's Fred Niblo." And she said, "You shouldn't know that. You're too young." I said, "Oh, but I'm very interested in silent film directors." "Oh, I'm married to one." "But you'd never have heard of him." I said, "What was his name?" "Joseph Henneberry." I said, "Abraham Lincoln." And she was so thrilled that I knew him, she immediately arranged that I should go out the following day, which suited me beautifully. And it was, I'd like to say it was one question and a 4-hour answer, but that's the feeling I had. He was Irish. He was so full of information that I just transcribed the chapter, transcribed the tape, and 28 pages it fitted, and that was the chapter in the book. And it was because of what he told me that I decided I had to write the book. English film historians tended to make things up when they couldn't find any solid information. And they decided the way that Griffith shot The Intolerance, Babylon, when the camera comes out, seems to come out of the clouds and float down over the city. They'd seen a publicity photo of Griffith in the basket of a captive balloon. So they said it was shot from a captive balloon. Well, think about it. Where does the rope go?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're looking down. And what do you do about the sway? You know, it doesn't work. Now, Henneberry said, no, it wasn't a captive balloon. Now, I don't... He said it was a... Imagine a siege tower, and into the siege tower we placed an elevator. We put it on mining rails, and grips pushed it slowly forward, and down came the elevator, or up went the elevator, according to what you wanted. Well, I was stunned, and actually thrilled, because I resented the historians inventing this explanation. And so that was the first chapter I did, and then I realized I had to do the rest of it. And that meant meeting Mary Pickford and things like that. And then it took about a year, but it was a spare time activity because I was a film editor by then.
And was it a problem meeting those people? I mean, Mary Pickford.
Mary Pickford. Coincidence? I just finished a film. My first and virtually only film was called It Happened Here, and it was about what might have happened if the British had lost World War II and been occupied by the Nazis. That only took 8 years to make. And it was acquired. It was financed to the tune of £3,000. It actually ended up costing £7,000. By Tony Richardson, whom I soon would work for as an editor. And he...
In charge of the Light Brigade.
Yes, and he was very closely involved with United Artists. And he said, I think I can get a United Artists to pick this up, because it turned out after Tom Jones, they thought anything he did was going to make money. So I went to see an American who ran UA in Europe called, wait a minute, Bud Ornstein, George Ornstein, known as Bud. And I don't know how we got onto the subject of Mary Pickford. I suspect he heard that I was interested in silent films. He had married Mary Pickford's niece, and he said, if you go to Hollywood, I'll fix you up with a meeting at Pickfair. And I said, well, I'm getting to New York and I can't get any further. And believe it or not, the reason I could get to New York was I was selling DeMille's King of Kings on 16mm to another collector who gave me enough for the airfare. And the producer from Woodfall, Oscar Lewinstein, was present, and he said, we'll finance you to go all the way. And so I got this appointment to go to Pickfair to meet the great lady, and it was like going to a museum. It was very peaceful, very silent. There wasn't anybody around. It seemed totally deserted. The secretary was there, Miss Helms, I remember her name was, and she gave me to understand I was unlikely to be meeting Miss Pickford. Was feeling a little off colour. So I was given a tour of the grounds. But no chance of meeting Pickford, which was desperately disappointing because I had seen a lot of her films and I was a great admirer. It was awful. So back to George Ornstein, and he said, "Don't worry, she's coming to town week after next into London." So I knew I would meet her this time for one reason, and that is I had acquired a film called The Goose Woman, and the star was Jack Bickford, and Mary wanted to see her brother again. Remember, he died in 1933 or something,
mm-hmm, yes.
And this was 65. So I was invited to their apartment, very plush apartment, as you can imagine, and I put the screen up, and I think it was 10 o'clock she was supposed to arrive, and it wasn't till 11:30 that I saw a pair of carpet slippers underneath the screen, like Chaplin in that thing with the bar door. Now, I knew she was a recluse, and I knew she suspected she was an alcoholic, and I thought I was going to have an awful lot of trouble. She was perfectly charming, very forthcoming, very funny, but also she had a touch of the Aunt Susans, you know, as though played by Zazu Pitts. And she would get on her high horse occasionally, especially about communists and things like that. But otherwise, talking about film, it was absolutely magical. And when she started talking about Lubitsch, I was in fits. And I put most of that in the book. And at the end she said, "Well?" At the beginning she said, "Kevin, I'm going to talk to you. You can open your notebook." And I thought, "What about my tape recorder?" But she didn't seem to notice that I switched on the tape recorder. And at the end she said, "I'm going to adopt you." So, also, what's her name? Gwyn Ornstein produced a whole lot of home movies that Mary had shot of her when she was about 5 years old. That was fascinating.
Wow.
I wonder what happened to them. But I kept in touch. I did the chapter. I sent the chapter to Mary Pickford, and she sent it back with her line, a line through one sentence. She was going to greet Lubitsch coming from Germany, and there was a great deal of opposition, and even generals had entered, and she said, "Oh, I was madder than a wet hen." She carefully put the line through that.
Now, I've always been given to understand that Pickford was one of those people who was kind of ashamed of her work or wanted to destroy it and didn't want people laughing at her.
He's gone later. Off with that very the very paragraph where she says this. She said, "I didn't want to happen to me what happened to Charlie. And I was going to destroy my films, but Lillian Gish taught me out of it." Yes.
So when she talked to you about her career, she talked about it with affection, not with...
Absolutely.
She was not...
Oh.
Didn't look back on it as something to be swept under the rug.
And what really depressed me was the thought that her career, to all intents and purposes, ended in the early 30s. And here we were 30 years later, and she hadn't been a part of the film industry. No wonder she took to the booze. It must have been so hard when she'd been... It must have been like taking heroin every 5 minutes, you know, being at the top of her profession and so highly praised and the best loved person in the world, because she was even more famous than Chaplin.
Yes.
It's hard to believe. And the standard that she maintained still astonishes me every time I see those films.
Yeah.
And it was... I ought to tell you this, because this is really important in my career and life and everything else. There was a man in Camden Town, which is a working class area of London, who worked in a piano factory, completely self-taught, and every Saturday night he ran silent 35mm original prints with full orchestral accompaniment on two turntables. He operated the handle of that and he was changing it. And we saw, his favorite star was Mary Pickford, and we saw one night a film called The Ragamuffin, which was the English title for The Hoodlum. And this was 1919, and it was of such a high standard of production that I wrote a fan letter to the cameraman, not knowing whether he was alive or not, care of the ASC. Never got an answer. You don't expect to get answers. But weeks later, I got a telephone call, and a very English voice said, "Bet you don't know who this is. It's Charles Rocha."
Wow.
And he was at a hotel in Victoria, and I went round to see him, and oh, the stuff he was telling me. But he wouldn't let me record him. It was so frustrating. You know, I wrote down as much as I could and put it in the book as well. But he never, ever allowed me to record him. Now, the funny thing was, when he heard that I'd seen Hoodlum, he wanted to see it. And, of course, that absolutely blew the mind of the collector. He placed tape recorders everywhere and picked up everything he said. And Rocha really opened up to him. And we became close friends. He took me and my mother on the HMS Bounty when it was moored at Tower Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was absolutely fascinating. He was... the only thing that really puzzled me, he was English, and yet he boasted all the time. He told you how wonderful he was. You knew how wonderful he was, but he wanted to make sure that you knew how wonderful he was. I found that really odd, for an Englishman particularly. But I found it's true of Marion C. Cooper was the same. He kept telling you how wonderful he was. And I mean, he couldn't have done more.
You would think that he would have heard that enough from others.
Yes, but, yes.
Oh, interesting. But didn't you find it to be the case that a lot of the people you were interviewing looked at their silent careers with a certain amount of sheepishness, that they...
Yes.
That they were under the impression that the stuff was no good?
Now, it so happened that with Rocha, I was able to show him the Killiam Silence Please of Tempest with Barrymore, which had been taken off the camera negative. And Rocha had designed a special lens to photograph Barrymore so that his dewlaps didn't show. It was just focused on the eyes. And if you look at that picture in an original print, and you see the moment that he's stripped of his rank, and they break the sword over the sergeant's knee, and you cut to Barrymore, and there are tears in his eyes, and that's all that's in focus. Everything else is soft. And to be able to show that to Rocha in that form. And I also did a deal with Bradley, and I got The Rushes of Sunrise. So without, the film wasn't available, and if it had been, it would have been in a horrible print, but this was right off the original, so it, even though it was 16mm, it looked superb. And that really bolstered him, because in the end, Rocha left me his Academy Award for Sunrise. But in Hollywood, it was standard practice. I remember ringing up Ralph Sargent, had a whole lot of Ince films. Do you remember Ralph Sargent?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Had a whole lot of Ince pictures he was running, and one of them was with Louise Glaum, and I happened to have her telephone number, and so I rang her up and invited her over. She said, "Who on earth would want to watch those awful old movies?" So I didn't meet her. But many cases, you're right, Reginald Denny, for instance, thought, "Oh, God, they must look awful." And luckily, Bradley had original prints, and we were able to show Skinner's dress suit to him and his family, and they were amazed. And that was very exciting to show them how good they were. The only time that failed was when I was going out again to see Henneberry, and I said, have you got anything of Henneberry's? And Bradley gave me a ghastly picture that he did. It was really awful. A program picture. No money. And Henneberry said, this is terrible! Why are we seeing it? But in the end, I found myself working for the American Film Institute Oral History Department with Sidney Franklin, and I used to take the prints out there in, where was it? Trampas, beyond there is where he lived, and that was very exciting, except he couldn't stand Garbo, and he couldn't bear Wild Orchids. Mm. I'm not sure he even got through it. It is quite heavy going, that picture. But he made an awful lot of really wonderful silence.
Very good, yeah.
Absolutely. Starting in the teens at the Griffith Studio.
Well, I started watching silent films, as I said, mostly through Black Hawk cut downs and whatever I could get at the public library on 8mm and that sort of thing. But it seemed to me, and this is in the early to mid 60s, that the only times we ever saw silent films, they were being mocked, shown on television with funny narration or sound effects and you know, honky tonk music and that sort of thing that just made them look ridiculous. And so I wonder if that wasn't a pervasive attitude toward silent films at that time, that they were these weird relics of a time when people didn't know how to make movies.
You could not have hit the nail harder on the head. The World War II generation despised silent films. And apparently what had happened was that companies like Warner's, that had invested everything in talkies, did not want silent pictures coexisting. They knew that sound was here to stay, but they didn't want these other things around. And so they took biographs, which were, as you know, always shot very slowly, sometimes 14, 15 frames mm-hmm. a second, and showed them at 24, so they were hilarious to begin with. They put the honky-tonk music on and commentary saying things like, it's doom for the groom unless he gets to his room. Mm-hmm. And people fell about and they thought, is that what we saw? Oh my God. And they really told me they were badly photographed, pathetically acted, ludicrous antiques. You know, forget about them. And I had my little 9.5s and I thought, they're brilliantly photographed. They're extremely well acted. They're very spectacular sometimes. That just doesn't add up. And so I became a one-man crusade trying to tell people, no, they're not like this, they're like this. And when I graduated to 16mm, I could sit them down and run a tinted original Kodoscope print of something like The Covered Wagon or Our Parents' People, and they were absolutely blown away because they really did think they were going to see It's Doomed for the Groom.
Well, during Oscar season this past year, the LA Times ran a series of small articles about Oscar voters, who are the people who are actually in the Academy who are doing voting.
Yeah.
And there was an actress I'd never heard of, who was in her 90s, 92 or so, and they asked her about The Artist, and she said, well, that's not really acting, it was that... You know, back in the old silent days, all you had to do was overact and just act ridiculous. And so it's still
pervasive. It's that
there.
World War II generation.
Yeah,
that's so annoying. God.
But I mean, I know that when I became fascinated, and of course I became fascinated because of Beaugest, the font from which everything springs, nobody else I knew, I mean, I was a teenager, I was 12 years old, 13 years old when I first started, and nobody I knew would even sit down and watch one Buster Keaton film with me. Nobody. So I was very much a voice crying in the wilderness. I was wearing animal furs and crying and matting my hair with mud.
But where did you see Beau Geste?
I didn't see the silent one for years. I saw the
39
the
one.
Which, of course, segues me perfectly into asking about when you met Wellman, because since that's the reason I bought your book, that's got to be... I never met him. He passed away before I ever got out to California. But he was a vivid personality, wasn't he?
I'm trying to think why I knew his name so well. What would I have seen in 64? No. I never saw that.
It must have just been from his sound film.
Because I remember him talking about Wings and thinking, oh, I'd love to see that. No, it was some...
You must have seen Public Enemy or Star is Born or...
I wouldn't have gone to see talking picture directors exclusively silent. So I can't remember the reason.
Well, he was in a movie directed by Albert Parker, so perhaps Knickerbocker Buckaroo.
So he was.
Yeah.
So
maybe that's the connection.
Well, I remember how flamboyant he was. Wonderful dialogue. Very handsome man. And I remember thinking he was pacing up and down like a caged lion in his living room. I loved his wife, too.
She was a wonderful Dottie.
Absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, everybody who ever met her fell in love, I think. She was the most wonderful woman.
But I obviously didn't know very much about him, and just accepted what he told me at the time, which was exciting enough.
Well, I'll tell you this. When I decided to write a book about Wellman, the first thing I ever wrote. Never wrote an article, never wrote anything. Started writing this book. And because I knew you had interviewed him, and I didn't know you at this time, this would be 1978 or so, I wrote to you and asked very stupidly and naively, I said, listen, if you have any interview with Wellman that you didn't use, I'd love to hear it just to hear other things. Sincerely, and never got any response.
Embarrassing.
No, it's not embarrassing at all. I finally met you in about 1981 or so. We were out of the Universal Sheraton Hotel, and over several days spent some time together and got to know each other a little bit. And the day we were leaving to go to the airport, we were both standing waiting for a shuttle to take us to the airport, and you said, I feel very guilty about something. And I said, what's that? He said, well, you wrote to me a long time ago and asked me for these interviews, and I didn't want to send them because I was afraid that you would think that Wellman was crazy and that you would lose interest in him. and so I assured you that if I thought he was crazy, I would just be more interested. So then you did send me a stack of tapes, which was incredibly generous of you, of all of your interviews with him in, as I recall, 64 and 69. Does that make sense?
Mm.
Two different. The 69 interview is frustrating to listen to because he had written his book or was writing his book, Short Time for Insanity. And so every time you asked him a question, he would say, well, that's in the book. And you would say, well, I'm not going to... This will come after your book. It was very frustrating.
That was the most common excuse that people gave throughout my years of interviewing. I remember particularly Gilbert Roland. I was trying to get him to talk about Keaton, and he kept saying, I'm writing my own book. And I used to have lunch with him, Jack Cummings, and J.J. Cohn.
Wow.
And the only time there was an intake of breath and a long silence was when I mentioned the name Skenk. And Gilbert Rowan said, "Why do you say that?" But I never, right at the end, Roland died, no book. Sure enough, he had written it, and someone sent me a copy of it. And it's not bad. In fact, it's a great story for a motion picture, because he was a newspaper boy who becomes a big, big star. And it's uncanny how all that happened. A Mexican newspaper boy.
That happened to me on several occasions. The most frustrating was George Chandler, who was, as you know, a character actor who was in, I'd say, 30-plus Wellman films. He was almost always there in some capacity. And the way Wellman always told it was that he loved Chandler because he could use him as a fall guy, that if Wellman was stuck, then he would give Chandler a signal and Chandler would mess up in some way to give Wellman an excuse to blow his top and storm off the set, and then he could go into his dressing room and figure out what he needed to do, so he wouldn't have to show weakness in front of the cast.
One
but I was introduced to Chandler. I went up to his house, and he graciously invited me up to his house in Sherman Oaks, and the entire interview is him just saying, that's a great story. It's in my book. Great story. And I would say, well, what about this on Nothing Sacred? Oh, man, that's a wonderful story. Yeah, that's in my book. And, of course, he never wrote a book. He never wrote a book. And I checked with people who knew him after he died, and I said, so was there manuscript? No, he never wrote anything. Never wrote a book. And just wouldn't give me a thing. I didn't get one sentence from him the entire interview.
Liam O'Leary was writing a book on Rex Ingram. And went to see Alice Terry, and she let him sit down and read Rex Ingram's memoirs. They've completely disappeared, and just recently I've been told that they're with someone called Andre Suarez, and I had contact with him before, but he no longer knows me, and I cannot get an answer from him, because I'm asking for the impossible.
Oh.
Isn't that frustrating?
Well, I told you, and it is, of course, roads always go back to Beaujolais, don't they? in Herbert Brennan's obituary, it says he recently finished his memoirs, which will be published soon. And this is back in, what, 57, something like that, when he died. And so when I read that obituary, I started looking everywhere. I started asking everybody I knew, writing to every archive I ever heard of. There's no memoirs anywhere. So, this has only been about 6 months ago, Rudy Bellmer, one of the great film historians, and a wonderful guy, wonderful man, just one day out of the blue called me up, and he said, so Frank, I was thinking about Beaujolais the other day, and I went through my files to see if I could see anything that would help you out in your project. And he said, the only thing I found was a bunch of articles by you, but, he said, but I found this chapter from Herbert Brennan's memoirs on the making of Beaujolais. And I, what? And he said, yeah, you want me to make a copy for you? I said, no, of course not. Leave me alone. And I said, where did you get him? He said, I had no idea. But it's the only chapter that's ever surfaced from these memoirs, and it's on Beaujolais. It's the only chapter. Does that tell you that God wants me to finish this project? That these weird things keep happening like that?
Okay, I'll tell you my Beaujolais story.
Okay. I need one.
What would happen if you put a silent film on in a big theatre in London with a live orchestra and a great motion picture?
Oh, it would be paradise.
It would be. We talked about it quite often with a chap called Philip Jenkinson, who has just died.
Oh, I'm sorry. I knew him slightly. I corresponded with him, yeah.
He was a television presenter of film on a program called Late Night Lineup. And the London Philharmonic must have contacted him, and he said, why don't you put on Beau Geste, get it from the Museum of Modern Art or wherever it is. And he must have known there was a score by Riesenfeld, who's a very fine composer and wrote the score for Sunrise. So this went ahead, and it was the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and they got the 35mm print, presumably from the Museum of Modern Art. It got as far as customs, and the customs charged so much money that Philip Jenkinson said, run my 16mm.
Oh, ouch.
And at Queen Elizabeth Hall, the projection box must have been in the hands of a former U-boat commander, because the image went from way up there via periscope down to mirrors, losing Ooh. Quality all the way, and it finally reached the screen, and you wondered whether it was Beau Geste or my friend Flicker. And I took my wife, who has a thing about Herbert Brennan, I can't understand it, she hates everything he ever did. And she was in absolute agony the whole evening. It looked awful. Actually, the score was quite exciting, and it made use of the New World Symphony, dun, 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 for the Arabs coming over the hill. And it nobody could have been impressed with that. It was the beginning and end of silent film and music in this country, in that country. Was with Beau Geste, it became notorious, and it wasn't until Carl Davis and David Gill and Thames Television put on Napoleon in 1980 that ushered in an era which lasted nearly 20 years of silence and live orchestra. But oh God, it would have been fabulous with a decent print. The other time I saw it, just to make up for that, was at Pordenone, where they had the 35mm print and a local orchestra, and it sounded as though you were hearing George Gershwin trying to play on the D-Day beaches. And that was unspeakable. All I can say in acknowledgement to Brennan is the film fought through, and it worked because you could see it and you could somehow forget about the music, which was not music at all. It was ghastly.
Well, last summer, the Academy ran a series of the Photoplay Gold Medal Award winners, and you were there to present The General and Big Parade, right? But they also showed Beau Geste, because it was one of those, and I introduced it. And there's no 35mm print to show. There is no 35mm print anywhere. This film is in much more trouble than we think it is. And luckily, in this case, we knew of a collector who had a 16mm print, which I saw and was actually stunned by, because it was beautiful. And so because they had to show it, because it was one of the Gold Medal Award winners, and this was what they were stuck with. But the projection at the Academy is so good that what they were going to do is show the 16mm print, and they told everybody what the story was, and then they had the final reel in 35mm, and so they were going to go for roughly the last, 15 minutes or so, would go to 35mm. And I must say that the 16mm print looked so nice and was so sharp that I had to turn to my wife at one point toward the end and say, this is 35mm now, because I don't think anybody would have particularly noticed otherwise.
Well, I would love that 16mm print.
It was gorgeous, because I'd seen it on 16 many times, and I had an 8mm print for years, and all the artwork behind the titles was always just this blob of stuff, and I never knew what it was. And so when I was seeing this 16mm print, which we screened in a private home theater a few weeks before that, the ships, you know, the Viking ships and all that from those early scenes, and just beautifully rendered art, perfectly sharp and perfectly nice. So it turned out to be, I was bracing for a disaster like you had, but it turned out to be much nicer than that. So, but yeah, I'm not in completely like your wife, but Herbert Brennan is not a very impressive director to me in many ways. Visually, he never seems that interesting. He always seems like it's always the proscenium. It seems like he's staging a you know, everything is full figure and it never seems that dynamic to me. But he's great with emotion and he's great with performers, and so I'm kind of flip-flopping on Herbert Brennan all the time. I guess you're not. You're looking at me with shock and shocked disgust.
Here's my story about Herbert Brennan. I used to live in a bed sitting room in Hampstead, and another fellow from Worldwide Pictures got a room next door, and we fitted his room up with projectors and gramophones and everything, and his landlady must have been deaf because we were very violent in our presentations. And I had just acquired a print of The Spanish Dancer, and the reason I acquired this was because it had been intended for Valentino, and it was going to be called The Spanish Cavalier. And Valentino and Natasha Rambova walked out of Famous Players Lasky, and they were stuck, and they gave it to Pola Negri and switched the story around a bit. And I thought I'd invite my assistant from Worldwide, Peter Watkins. And he's a fellow that made The War Game.
Sure.
And he was just starting out and didn't know much about film history, and so looked it up in The Film Till Now by Paul Rother, which is vicious about Hollywood films. And during the break...
Poisoned many a mind, didn't it?
Yeah. Yes. During the break, real break, early in the film, he said, "It's quite true. Herbert Brennan's cinematic interpretation is negligible." I just wanted to punch him on the nose. I was apoplectic. And I realized where he got it from, where he told me where he got it from. And I gave him a lecture. And at the end of the picture, he was very impressed. Now, fade out, fade in. I'm in Pordenone. And they suddenly show a restored version of The Spanish Dancer. And just what happened with Napoleon happens to this. I know The Spanish Dancer intimately. And it ain't this. What they're showing is all that isn't in the 16mm Kodoscope version. So that excited me. And I told them, actually I got up. This is unforgivable. I got up and I said, "What you have seen is not The Spanish Dancer. It's much better than this. It's got a much better..." You know, they were furious. And they froze me out of anything to do with the Dutch film. And finally, I said to them, they'd changed enough staff, "Why don't you restore it? You can use my print, you can use this." And they'd done it. And Herbert Brennan's Spanish Dancer is infinitely better than the 16mm version, as you believe, and it'll be shown in Pordenone this year. So I hope you will. You'll also see it at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. It's witty, beautiful, shot by James Wong Howe. Art direction is a knockout. Very, very elaborate, because they were poor... Paramount were so upset at Valentino complaining at the rotten production values, and they really lay it on. And he takes a great deal from Velasquez, so he has a visual eye.
Well, I must say, when it comes to Brennan, of course, I love Beaugest. And
have you ever seen Kiss for Cinderella?
Kiss for Cinderella, I love. And Peter Pan, the first time I saw it, I was working at Disney at the time, and Scott McQueen was
restoring
it. And he's as close to a genius at things like that as anybody I've ever met. Beautiful work. But we were watching it just as a work print in the theater, silent and everything. And I was thinking, well, it's perfectly well and good, but it kind of lays there as far as I'm concerned. And then I saw it with an orchestra, and it completely came to life, and it was totally charming, and I loved everything about it. So it really does speak to how much silent film requires being properly shown to be at its best advantage. Although, you know, when I hear your stories and when I think back of my own stories, I was watching terrible things, just these cut-down prints, and was completely enthralled by the whole thing. So, who knows? Maybe we either get it or we don't. I don't know how else to say it.
There's a Brennan picture called Sorrel and Son, which is lost, and somebody found it. And it had been printed for a producer in the 40s who was thinking of remaking it. And he didn't give a damn what it looked like. And so the lab just blasted through a piece of film, and it came out with the faces blank like that box. Mm. And it works. It's emotional as it was originally, even though you can't see the expressions. I don't know how he does it.
Mm.
Amazing.
He was awfully good with people. That's absolutely... I just think he had a very prosaic cinematic style.
The cinematic interpretation was negligible. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. It was negligible. But... Well, when I compare his Borges to Wellman's, and Wellman's has major problems too. I mean, it's cast very peculiarly, but it's dynamic as it can be. And when you compare, say the Brennan where the Arabs first attack the fort, all the legionnaires, all the action is inside. All the legionnaires are running up to the wall, and there's this swarm of ants on the sand dunes, and they're firing away at this swarm. But the Wellman film, as soon as Francis McDonald comes to the door and says, "Toregs," it cuts to these galloping hooves, the camera pulls back to this Toreg, and then it, you know, the close-up of his face, and then it pulls back, and there's all these galloping Toregs. It's just dynamic as it can be. It's
Joe Youngerman again?
Joe Youngerman was probably... now that you say this, I was about to tell you who was the second unit director. And his name just went right out of my head. Oh, well, I'll fix that in post. a lot of the action stuff was done after Wellman left. With Wellman leaving written instructions on what to do, but a lot of the stuff outside the fort is shot second unit afterwards. And
I thought Youngerman did a bloody good job on Light That Failed.
He did.
The battle scene,
yes.
In that was wonderful.
Yeah, I interviewed Joe a couple of times. Did you ever meet him?
I met him, but I didn't realize who he
was. He was a very dull guy. but he had great experiences to tell, and he told me a good story of Light That Failed, that Yakima Canutt and four stuntmen were supposed to leap over a cannon as it fired, and they had this on horseback, of course, and that the cannon fired just a little off, so that the smoke obscured the stunt completely, and Joe said he was just bereft. He said, they're going to kill me for this, and I didn't get the shot. And he said, and Canutt came to his room that night and said, "Look, we'll do it again for free if you want us to do it again." And they came back and they did the stunt again, and it worked. And he said, "I've always been grateful to that Yakima Canutt ever since. He's always been a great guy to me."
Wonderful.
But I this is completely off track, but I just remembered another great story that he told me. So Proudly We Hail, the Mark Sandrich film from 1942, primarily female cast. And as you may remember, there was a time when it was believed that women, when they were having their monthly time, could not go into the water.
Oh, yeah.
When we're not supposed to bathe or go swimming or anything like that. And so Joe said part of his duty was he had a large chart made, Claudette Colbert, Veronica Lake, everybody, and charted when their periods were happening so that they, because there was a lot of going through rivers and all this and the thing. And I said, Joe, do you realize what that chart would go for in the collector's market today? You'd make a fortune. But sadly, it was gone.
Funny. Good God, the things you have to think of making pictures. Oh, that's amazing.
Well, Kevin, there's a million more things to talk about, but we've been going on for a while, so I will bring it to a stop. Because if you want to do a 5-hour podcast, I'm willing to do it. I mean, after all, I'm going to sit through a 5.5-hour movie on Saturday, so why not? But let's call it a halt if you'll promise to me that we'll do this again at some future day.
Absolutely. If you promise to give me lunch.
Yes. Lunch is on me. So thank you very much, Kevin. This has been fun for me.
Fascinating for me, too.
Always got a little room tone.
There's a little square on each of your faces, so you should be focused. 1, 2, 3.
I can't understand why it doesn't flash.
Do you want a flash?
How did the picture look?
It looked okay. I'm going to hold it as still as I can. I'll do another. 1, 2, 3. Okay. One more?
Sure, for safety. We'll act like we're still talking.
Do you want me to pop the flash? Did the flash go off?
I saw some little flash. It wasn't really a flash.
It was just the amber light went on.
Well, is there something that can pop up to make it go on? It looks fine.
I think it's, as long as it's coming out okay. That's
if you get light in this light, I'm amazed.
It's the light.
I'll torture you again.
Yeah, you can try that.
The light that failed to fail.
All right, I'll count three. 1, 2, 3.
Ooh!
Well, that's definitely...
Great.
I tell you the worst thing about the Oscar ceremony is when they get you on the red carpet and 60 of those are going off at once. You feel your eyeballs are being taken out with spoons. And I said to Sid Gannis, the president, I think he is, you've got the greatest lighting cameraman in the world. Why don't you get one of them to light this? And they can all take a beautiful looking shot without damaging the poor people.
That evening must have been a slight torture for you.
Yes, the only thing was the November one was so entertaining.
Yeah.
They had Phil Alden Robinson, who did Field of Dreams, mm-hmm. and he insulted Goddard so creatively and so amusingly that you couldn't possibly object, or he couldn't possibly object, because you remember he was given the award and he didn't turn up.
Sure.
And then... Oh, what's the old actor's famous...
Eli Wallach?
Eli Wallach got up and he said, I'm going to tell you a story.
Yes.
And he said, this fella's father was going to be 90. And the son says, I'm going to give him something he'll never forget. I'm going to give him something he wants. I'm going to give him a hooker. So he arranged... The hooker got into her best clothes and turns up at the front door and rings the bell. And the old man comes to the door. What do you want? She says, I'm going to give you super sex. And he says, I think I'll settle for the soup.
My main memory of this night, in which I told my wife and regaled her with this, was that you came up to me at one of the breaks. You were walking past to do something else, and you just walked past me, and you said, I just met Claude Jarman Jr. My evening is made.
Yes.
And I said, well, you're getting an Oscar, you know. your evening should be made by that, right? But
well, that was so exciting. That really was. Clarence Brown had found him in the Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
That's a classroom. And chose him for... Because, you know, the Yearling was made before, by Victor Fleming, and it was a disaster. They had to scrap it.
Did they scrap the entire thing?
Yeah.
Was it from
absolutely
top to bottom?
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
and Charles Rocha photographed there was the replacement cameraman.
Yeah, that's a wonderful film, isn't it?
Mm.
And he's so touching, and he's just what a charming kid.
Is absolutely great. And he's an Intruder in the Dust. He's brilliant in that. What a picture that is!
Sure.
And nobody could possibly be more right wing than Clarence Brown, and yet he produces a film like that. It's staggering.
See, that's another thing. You interviewed Clarence Brown finally, didn't you? I mean, that's...
I knew him very well and stayed with him. And he said, you can help yourself to any still you want. And there was a great filing cabinet in the garage. And I produced all these stills and took them in and said, I found those wonderful stills in your collection. He said, well, you can't have that. You can't have that. I need that one. So frustrating.
See, I told you there was a little bonus footage at the end of that. I hope you stuck around. Of course, if you didn't, then you wouldn't be listening to this, so how would you know? Always delightful talking with Kevin. If you were listening closely, you heard the inadvertent beginning of my only slightly annoying, I hope, catchphrase that I use at the end of every episode when something went a little bit kerflooey and I told Kevin that we would fix it in post. And so I decided I would just always say that. And then, see, the funny part is, I never fix it in post. That's how you get it. See, I laugh. Anyway, thanks to Gary Rand and Rob Clearfield for my wonderful theme music. Thanks to my delightful wife, Claire, for being my announcer. Thanks to James Hutchin for designing my website, The Commentary Track. I hope you will go to thecommentarytrack.com, and if you click on Kevin's podcast page and then click on View Full Details, you will see that I have listed books and videos on which he has worked. And if you don't have his books, you really, really do need to have them. And the best way to get them is to click on those Amazon links, buy them through Amazon, and it will cost you not one penny extra, but it will give me a little bit of a kickback from Amazon, and that would be most welcome. So I really hope that you have enjoyed this conversation with Kevin Brownlow. Next week we will be back with Kevin's partner in crime on this particular Napoleon caper, Mr. Carl Davis, who wrote and conducted the score for Napoleon. And I hope you will be here next week for that. So thanks, see you next time, and don't worry, we'll fix it in post.